Hello and welcome to New Books in Photography. I am the host, Lorena Turner. I'm a lecturer in the Communication Department at California State Polytechnic University in Pomona, California, and I'm also a photographer. On New Books in Photography, I talk with people who are practicing photographers in the area of documentary, fine art, academic art, and photojournalism. There is an archive of past episodes of this podcast at the New Books Network website, as well as links to other podcasts in the New Books Network. A personal favorite of mine this past week has been New Books in Critical Theory. Maybe you'd like that. In this episode, I talk with Stephen DuPont about his book, Pisgah, New Guinea, which was published in 2013. His book is in two volumes. One is Portraits of People Living in Remote Areas of Papua New Guinea, and the other, called Diaries, are written thoughts, newspaper clippings, and other ephemeral materials that he collected while he was working on his project. Stephen conducted this work with the support of a Robert Gardner Fellowship of Photography from Harvard's Peabody Museum of Archaeology and Ethnology. Stephen's an Australian photographer and has worked in countries around the world and has produced numerous books of his work in both traditional and experimental forms. Our conversation starts with Stephen describing his love of photography as it's connected to the book form. Hello and welcome to New Books in Photography. Today I'm talking with Stephen DuPont about his fantastic book, Pisgah, New Guinea. It was published in 2013 by Radius Books and the Peabody Museum Press. Welcome to the podcast, Stephen.
Thank you, Lorena. Thank you.
So your book, Pisgah, New Guinea, is just a gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous book. I cannot say that enough. I was so impressed when I got it and flipped through the pages and then went back multiple times and took a look at it. And I was wondering if you could start by telling me what the book is about.
Well, the book is essentially, it looks inside detribalization in Papua New Guinea. So it's really a kind of window into society and tribal culture, but also the obvious changes that are taking place at the time that I made the photographs. I really wanted to really show, you know, what was happening at that particular time and how things were changing and how the culture is changing. So, you know, the influences of the West, of globalization and all these things that are going on, this real clash in a way of civilizations. You know, it's New Guinea is one of these incredibly complex, very tribal countries, which have only really in terms of world discoveries, the highlands were discovered in the 1930s, when first contact was made. So they've literally, stepped out of the Stone Age quite recently. And so it's fascinating to see just the impact that something like we take for granted, like the mobile phone, now social media and internet, just how that's affected the society there. It's quite amazing.
Well, we're gonna talk about that at length, I'm hoping, in a few minutes. Yeah. I'd like to know about your work as a photographer, your history as a photographer, and then perhaps you could tell us specifically why you went to that region, why that was a place that became a focal point for you for a while.
Well, look, I guess I see myself going through a bit of a mid-career phase at the moment as a photographer. It's been about 25 years of photography, and when I first picked up a camera, I was inspired by some of the great photographers at our times, people like Robert Frank and Josef Kudelka, and in particular a British photographer by the name of Don McCullen. I mean, these were heavy inspirations on me to become a photographer, and I think I was particularly inspired by photo books, and that was always my my main passion through photography was to make photo books. And so I've you know, spent a much of my my life just, you know, working on you know, major long-term projects with books in mind, with that being the ultimate platform and showcase. And I still work like that today. And I have a real love for handmade artist books, and I design my own books, and I make books, and I get books published. So I, you know, photography for me is essentially about the art of books. And, you know, I sort of, you know, I guess started, working as a news photographer when I first picked up a camera, and as a photojournalist covering, you know, major stories around the world for magazines and newspapers. And as the industry changed, I felt I needed to change with it. And I really, I guess about 15 years ago, really sort of heavily made an impact in terms of trying to focus on you know, photo artist books and photo books in general. And I really then started to kind of think more about, you know, self-publishing and also working on projects with books in mind. You know, I did less magazine work and much more personal work, and I guess that's where I kind of ended up today, you know, just focusing on these photography books.
And do you have particular regions or concepts or themes that your books you focus your projects around?
Yeah, I always saw my projects in thematic ways, and I think that I've got a you know, I'm interested in disappearing worlds, you know, for a start. I mean, I'm interested in change. I'm interested in things that are disappearing from our planet, and that is, you know, can be anything from cultures to you know, physical things that are disappearing and changing. So for me, it's about documenting history. And I've always been drawn toward, I guess, conflict and cultures, you know, that are changing. And so I've spent a lot of time going in and out of, you know, many different sort of countries, from Afghanistan to Africa, the Middle East, and most recently Papua New Guinea, where my book Pics in New Guinea is featured from. And that really came out of a strong connection with New Guinea from being so close to the country. I mean, it's my closest neighbor. I'm Australian, and we have a history with New Guinea, and I'd always wanted to go and explore there. I had this real, you know, for a long time, a desire to get up there and make pictures. And so I think in 2004 was the first time I went to New Guinea, and then I made a project on rascals, which is in Pidgin means criminal. And there are these gangs in the capital, Port Moresby, that I focused on. And in the end, that actually became a published book called Rascals. And then I traveled back and forwards doing various other projects. And I guess that was sort of leading into the next book, which is the book we're talking about, Pics in New Guinea. I was fortunate to be awarded the Robert Gardner Fellowship in Photography from Harvard's Peabody Museum. And that allowed me to really go much deeper into the work of New Guinea that I'd already started. I spent all of 2011 basically traveling around the country, really kind of going deep inside the society and the culture trying to investigate this whole concept of detribalization and how things were shaping and how they were changing there. And it took me from Port Moresby to the highlands, to the Sepik River and other places in New Guinea to try and sort of show, you know, what's happening there today, how, you know, both visually and sort of, you know, anthropologically, you know, it's really kind of a look inside the people and through photography, of course, you know, and in the end, also through my observations and my diaries and sketchbooks, which were, as you know, were published in those two volumes. So it was very much a visual journey through this incredibly, you know, ancient and complex country that is New Guinea.
Well, that leads me to the question of what was going on there in terms of detribalization? Is that the term that you used?
Yeah, detribalization. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Describe what you saw there at the time, 2011, and that's probably shifted quite a bit now in 2016, but take us back to 2011 and what were you seeing at the time?
Well, I think the main impact was technology in terms of mobile phones. You know, I mean, literally the mobile phone was only just coming in 2011. It hadn't really, you know, let alone the internet and social media. So, you know, there was this new thing with mobile phones, and it was also the impact that was having on these remote communities. So the phone, the telephone, mobile phones were getting out to really remote communities around the country, and that was having a major impact on the change of things going on there. The fact that for the first time people could actually be mobile and actually speak to people, you know, relatives, friends, whatever, in all different parts of the country and be connected in that way. And then, of course, you know, you had the sort of beginnings of Facebook in that country too at that time, and that was having a huge impact in terms of just something so radically different for the people of New Guinea. And now, because I've been going back, I was there 6 weeks ago, and it's just exploded. I mean, I don't think there's many people who don't have phones anymore. It's just this major, you know, sort of shift in literally kind of, you know, this culture that has, you know, fairly recently just stepped out of, you know, not the Stone Age, but just stepped out of, you know, ancient times in a way, you know, and I think the impact that that advertising and technology in all its forms has had a huge impact on the youth and the older generations, that you see these impacts all over the place. You see it in incredibly remote places where, you know, not so long ago, they would just wouldn't exist there, you know. So it's really it's just been really fascinating to really kind of see that, you know, that change. I think also the physical change of people too, you know, when you look at their culture and their dress and their tribalness in terms of their sort of the way that they've been brought up in the villages, and that's radically changing as well, and you know, the grass huts, although are still there, yet, you know, metal roofs and sort of brick houses and things like that are quickly taking over and having a major change there, which is fairly recent, and even clothing, you know, just Western clothes, you know, the whole kind of, you know, Western culture has just completely eroded, you know, this ancient culture, and that, you know, that's happening, of course, all over the world, but But what's interesting about New Guinea is that, you know, this is a people that have really, you know, I think held on to their traditional culture for so long, and only sort of recently have had this, you know, massive, you know, kind of blow, this massive impact, and in a very short space of time. And and I think that when that happens, it's not a gradual process. It's like being hit with a baseball bat. I mean, they've just literally had to take it and run with it, and that's causing all sorts of issues too. I mean, you know, there's a country where you have, you know, up to 80% unemployment, and so you've got, you know, masses amount of people just hanging out, and when people hang out, they, you know, they're drawn to just being on a mobile phone and using the internet and kind of, you know, so, and that raises a lot of issues too. You know, I think that.
Do you think there's a generational, a difference in response based on the generation who is using the mobile phone? So like, so are the, say, for example, is the younger generation, say people 25 and under, are they more apt to kind of welcome these changes and to adopt Western styles, whereas older people may not be, or is it kind of reversed?
Oh, look, certainly it's like here in, you know, it's like our culture in terms of it's the young generation that are really, you know, just taking it in a big way
and moving it forward.
Yeah. Certainly that is the obvious, you know, observation that I've been having out there, and you know, and I think that rightfully so, they want to be just like the rest of the world. You know, they want to be in touch, they want to be online, they want to take photographs, and they want to use Instagram, and they want to be, you know, connected, you know. And
well, it sounds like they want to participate, that's a big,
they do. Yeah. They've been, you know, it's been you know, a very remote situation for them for such a long time that suddenly they have a voice for the rest of the world. They can actually, you know, say something and have, you know, have that sort of connection, which I think is incredibly exciting for them, and as it is for a lot of people. So, but it sort of, you know, has its own issues too, you know, and I think that, I think they, you know, there needs to be, I think a lot of kind of care taken too, and to be aware that, just the, you know, the negative impact that these kind of things can have on, especially some of these more traditional remote communities.
Mm-hmm. Did you see evidence of that, of negative impact?
Well, I think it's the same, you know, what we'd see in most places where, you know, children might be faced with, you know, dangerous material through the internet, you know, mm-hmm. dangerous graphic mm-hmm. material and things like that. I think there's all of those kind of worries. Mm-hmm. I think that just technology in general, I think it's just such a culture shock, you know, to mm-hmm. to these communities, and I think that's obviously having, you know, just such an incredible impact on them, and so you know I have certainly seen, you know, some big changes taking place there, and but there's certainly you know, there's a great desire for this change too, I have to say. I think most mm. people that. And I, you know, I think that's partly what I was trying to capture in my books, was to really look at this incredibly complex ancient culture and look at their traditions and their customs and somehow, you know, try and capture that. And I did that through their festivals, their sing-sings, they call them, where they do get together and show off their their tribalness and their culture and custom and dance and sing and wear costumes. And then, you know, and then juxtapose that with, you know, advertising things happening around Coca-Cola, Digicel, things that are actually there on the spot that are real contrast to their traditions, and then bring in more urbanized Papua New Guineans from the villages to the city, and you know, kind of look at small elements of, you know, how they are losing their culture and how they might be trying to hold on to their culture. And so that was sort of shown visually in sort of certain photographs that, you know, there might be, say, for example, you know, a guy living in Port Moresby in the capital who's totally westernized and is wearing a, you know, a basketball T-shirt or, you know, something with Bob Marley or whatever. And then he's got this intricate piece of jewelry, you know, a headband that, you know, goes back to the beginnings of his people, you know, that this incredibly beautiful tribal headband with maybe some face paint or something. But so you see this incredible, you know, kind of clash and now the mixing of the two. I found that really quite fascinating, and I was trying to sort of see that through my photography, how Western goods are starting to be implemented even into their own costumes, you know, using Coca-Cola bottle tops and making them into their, you know, their intricate costume wear and, you know, all sorts of things that are quite fascinating and obviously being used, you know, because that's what's available. Things have changed. We are living in this whole new world.
So you're from Australia and Papua New Guinea is close by. And is there a particular understanding of the people, like a generalized understanding of the people of Papua New Guinea by Australians?
Look, the truth is, you know, we have an incredible history with Australia. We were former colonists of the country. We really sort of, I guess, started going there from the 1930s. Actually, it was a couple of Australian gold prospectors who made the original first contact up in the Highlands, Michael and Dan Lay. And, you know, since that time, Australia has had this continuous connection with New Guinea. But what's interesting today with, you know, Australians today, right now, is that and what's sad is that they know very little about New Guinea. And that's one of the reasons that sort of spurred me on to go and kind of explore the country, is because, you know, in Australia, we're not talking about New Guinea. You know, it's, you know, we're talking about the rest of the world, or we're talking about our own country, but New Guinea rarely gets a mention, and so a lot of people don't know what's going on up there, as does the rest of the world, of course. But it's, you know, Australia should know, and it's sad that it's not that way. So that was certainly you know, an important thing for me, was to really kind of get a focus on New Guinea and start to talk about it and start to make photographs for history's sake, you know, because it's just not being covered, and it's always been seen as this remote, you know, anthropological kind of place, and the tourism is quite small, and that's got a lot to do with the dangers, you know, unfortunately. But yeah, so, you know, definitely, I think that in Australia we could learn a lot about what's going on there, and you know, and so forth.
When I was looking at your book, my thoughts were kind of, you know, focused like first on the photos and then kind of going through it a number of different times, I started to wonder who your intended audience was for the book. Was it your fellow countrymen? Was it the people of New Guinea? Was it just a general audience? And it sounds like it's probably a combination of all of those.
Yeah, it is. It's a combination. It's for a general audience. It's for, you know, it's for the world. It's for everyone. I mean, I wasn't really sort of focusing on one particular audience. I really felt that, it felt important enough to be able to go in there and make these pictures and come out with, a sense of place and time, and history. So it was kind of, for me that was important. And I, not to mention that, it's just such a compelling and fascinating place to travel in and experience. And I always drawn toward these kind of places of the unexpected, and I really kind of feel inspired when I'm sort of in a place that there's not a lot of material out there on, or not a lot of photographs or coverage, and so New Guinea had all these incredible things to offer, and that was exciting, because it really kind of gave me an open canvas to go in there and make these pictures and talk about it and write about it.
Sure. In doing a little research so that we could talk today, I read a little bit about Frank Hurley, who did some work, but many decades before you. Was he someone that you looked to at all when you were preparing for your work in New Guinea?
Certainly, yeah. I mean, I've known of Hurley's work for a long time, and his photographs from New Guinea did have some influence on me. Absolutely. I mean, the work of Margaret Mead, and various writers, that have sort of traveled up there, and even Robert Gardner. And filmmakers. I mean, I have to say one of the greatest influences was Bob Connolly, who made three, incredibly important films, documentary observational films, First Contact, about the Lay brothers that I mentioned earlier, Joe Lay's Neighbors and Black Harvest. These films were seminal films about New Guinea and I guess one of the first major introductions for me that sort of got me incredibly interested in going there, and funnily enough, I mean, I've become very close with Bob Connolly over the years, and we've just recently returned from New Guinea, where I made a documentary film about him returning to the Highlands after 25 years, so going back for the first time and finding the characters in his films and reconnecting himself to these places and these people again and documenting that, which was an incredible experience.
How was that for him? Was he surprised? I'm sure it was emotional. I'm sure there was that.
God, I mean, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Surprised, absolutely emotional. People were it was a sort of a mix of jubilation and absolute passion and tears and joy, and
wow,
it was phenomenal, and it was great to make a film about that and to really sort of be a part of someone like him who has such an incredible history there and to really experience that that sort of impact and reaction from people, mm-hmm. I mean, it was great. And I think that, all of these stories, whether they're the books I'm making or the photographs or the films, for me, it's all one. It's all about, being someone who can go and document life in New Guinea and and be able to show, you know, to show an audience, people around the world, what this country is about, you know.
Sure, sure. Well, let's talk more about the portraits. So we didn't say this outright at the beginning of our conversation, but your book has two volumes that are included, and one is portraits and one is diary, and they're diaries. I'm sorry, and they're bound separately. So we're going to talk about the portraits one first. Yep. What I observe in the book, just in terms of format and what you're shooting, it looks like you're using different media to shoot with. So primarily film, large format, but some Polaroid mixed in or some instant film.
Mm-hmm.
And are you using a large format camera too?
Yeah, I'm using a 4x5 large format camera and a medium format 6-7 and then various other formats within the context of the both books. But the portrait work, which is shot on a mixture of film and Polaroid, is all on 4x5, so large format. And I have developed started earlier than that, but essentially I was inspired to take a white sheet with me and make photographs, make portraits of people in the field, and to sort of in a sense bring the studio to the people, and that sort of is something that, you know, goes back in time to the gold rushes and early photography, early anthropological photography, where this kind of portraiture was done, and so that was a sort of an inspiration too in the style. But I wanted to create something different again, where I could, you know, have someone hold up the sheet or have two people hold the sheet as their backdrop to the subject, and then have these, you know, real spontaneous, you know, documentary moments that came into my frame. So, you know, essentially having the sort of directed sitter in front of the sheet, but waiting for moments to happen where a dog might walk into frame or people might start to descend and come into frame on the edges of the frame as a sort of an audience that don't necessarily know they're being photographed. So all these wonderful kind of elements around the periphery was what I was always looking for. So it's an environmental kind of portraiture session that I was sort of creating. And this is kind of this approach to the portraits was something that I originally came across in Afghanistan back in 2006, where I made a series called Axe Me Biggie. And that was using a local photographer's backdrop, and that's where I sort of discovered this sort of incredible thing happening around the edges of the frame, where, you know, the audience was starting to come into frame and people were starting to come into frame, and so I took that concept to New Guinea, and I've since been developing, which is another project called the White Sheet series, where I'm photographing different communities now with the white sheet. So I really did a lot of, you know, explored a lot of things with that, with the portrait work. So that was great. I mean, I really, you know, I loved doing that. I loved that, you know, trying to sort of find new ways to, I guess, to bring portraiture into, you know, into my photography, and mixing, I guess, studio-like portraits with documentary for me was really great.
I had some notes that I took on those portraits where you have the white backdrop and there are people kind of lined up on the edges of the sheet looking at the camera. I really like those too. I think those are wonderful. And yeah. I'm wondering if I have had my own experience in Rwanda photographing children with a backdrop that I brought and had that kind of spillover happen. Yeah. And I noticed that having an audience as a part of the process of taking the picture absolutely changed the dynamic between myself and the sitter, but then who wanted to be in front of the camera. you know, mm-hmm. became something that was completely out of my control in a wonderful way. Did you have that experience, a similar experience?
Absolutely. Yeah. Look, I love the, you know, the surprise element of what was happening and coming in and out of frame. So I would wait for these moments. I would wait for the moment to take the photograph. And I really felt that the connection and the collaboration between me, the photographer, and the sitter, and then also the people holding up the sheet. It felt like this wonderful, collaboration to make the photographs. It wasn't just about me trying to capture these pictures. It was me with other people involved, and then all these wonderful elements of the crowd coming in, or the sheet suddenly being dropped, or these wonderful mistakes, these wonderful mishaps, these sort of surprise things that allowed me to then capture the photographs that I wanted to capture. So that was always really, you know, kind of seminal and really kind of close to my, close on my mind to really kind of watch out for things like that. I didn't want it to be just a photograph of someone sitting in front of a sheet. I wanted there to be other elements. So I was kind of waiting for the surprise things to happen.
It also makes it becomes more of a portrait of a community, I think, you know, and it's interesting to watch too, how people, the behavior of people in that type of situation, which probably, you know, they probably don't have a lot of experience with, you know, the type of situation that you're creating for them. And so the way that they are responding to it, you know, either be directly in front of the camera or observing what you're doing and the dynamic that's happening with the person you're photographing is something that's very genuine and spontaneous, you know, on their part.
Absolutely.
Which is pretty joyful on your part to witness.
Mm. Mm. And most of the time the sitter is obviously, you know, acknowledging, you know, you and knowing that they're being photographed. But what was wonderful is the people around the edges didn't know they were being photographed.
Right.
And so you know, for me, it was really that sort of contrast between the sitter and then the other people that didn't know they were being photographed. It sort of, you know, then allowed me to really capture some really wonderful moments and that sort of surprise element and the people being completely natural and have no sort of, being sort of self-conscious or anything like that, you know, that was really great. And that's been this really, a strong connection in terms of, you know, future bodies of work that I've been doing with the White Sheet, with other communities and other people, it's actually the most recent work that's about to be exhibited in Sydney in about a month, which is called the White Sheet Series. And it will include some of the work from New Guinea and other countries.
Oh, fantastic. Let's talk about the diaries. Sure.
It's the diaries book. So that's the two volumes. You've got the portraits and the diaries. And the diaries are really, it's a sort of a scrapbook of sorts and, you know, includes my contact sheets and my edit notes and then my actual diaries, handwritten diaries and collage work and drawings and actual Polaroids and things like that. In a sense, you're looking at a storyboard and you're looking at research and you're looking at all the kind of influences and inspirations and things that I kind of did along the way, you know, as I'm going through this journey. So it was really just, you know, things that I collected and things that I wrote about and then it was, you know, we assembled it into the design and edit. So it really works as a wonderful companion to the portraits. So essentially you're being taken on the same kind of journey, but in a whole other way. So the diaries sort of, you know, really kind of take you through the landscape, and you get a feel for all these other things that are going on within the context of the same people, whereas the portraits are much more formal in that way. So it sort of gave, you know, I think a lot of space to, you know, for the reader to really sort of go deep inside, you know, not just having, you know, the visualness of the portraits, but I wanted to really allow people a little bit into my soul, I guess, and allow people into me and who I'm about and why, you know, the kind of editing process and the kind of things that I observed and thought about and reflected on and all these things. So it's really kind of giving back something quite personal and you know, yeah, a personal reflection on the things that I saw and the things that I did out there.
Well, that was actually what my question was going to be about, giving back, before we talked about the diaries. So I'm glad you used that phrase. My question was about when you're working in any context, and, you know, certainly speaking to your experience in the book we're talking about, but do you take pictures of, do you take portraits of people within communities, and then do you give them back portraits as a kind of, like, almost like a thank you, or, you know, some kind of acknowledgement of, I don't, that's the yeah, not exactly the right word, but I think you understand what I'm asking.
I do, and I have done that. I mean, particularly, I don't so much anymore because it's really hard to get Polaroid film, but when I was shooting Polaroid, particularly you know, we have to go back to my original project, Axmi Biggie, in Kabul in 2006, where I made 100 portraits. I made I took 100 photos of 100 people, so one frame per person. And I gave everyone the Polaroid and I kept the negative. So it was a pos-negative film made by Polaroid, which they don't make anymore. And that was great because it allowed me, again, you know, you talk about giving back, and you know, as a photographer, I feel that I take so much away from people and never get an opportunity to give something back, and this was the perfect sort of opportunity to actually, you know, give someone the photograph, so have that direct connection, that direct participation and exchange. You know, I really felt this wonderful exchange with people allowing me to take their portrait and then receiving a photograph as a gesture of my thanks. And I've tried to do that as much as possible. It's really hard now when there's no Polaroid, but certainly while I was doing Polaroid, I would try and give Polaroids to my subjects as much as I could.
Wow. Well, what are you working on now? What are some a current project, or if you have a number of different things you're working on?
I'm always working on a lot of things, and I'm mostly, you know, I'm working on several book projects right now. I've just did an archival book on a book called We Cut Heads, which is my pictures of barbershops from the last 25 years, which I've just curated and edited into a book, and that I've just finished. And I guess the most current project I'm working on right now, photographically, is around death. I'm sort of working on an ongoing project around death and the rituals of death. And that's sort of been taking me to India and Bangladesh, Namibia, and I'm about to go to Mexico City in a couple of weeks to work down there with sort of, well, the Day of the Dead Festival is one of the sort of elements, but also looking at crime photography in Mexico City and going into photography in a more forensic kind of way. So looking at death through forensic, you know, crime photography, and so that's really fascinating. That's sort of I guess my most recent, my latest obsession, you know, is really trying to focus on this project around death and really look into many different aspects of it and try and kind of, I'm still trying to figure it out, but try and sort of work out this, you know, this new project and really kind of show these elements around death that, you know, the subject that most people find quite taboo and don't want to talk about, and yet it's, you know, one of the most important, if not, you know, life and death, they are the two most important sort of, you know,
tentpoles of our lives.
That is, it's life and death. And so, you know, to confront death and I guess to explore that, you know, through my photographs, that's an incredible journey that I'm taking, and I'm really, really excited about the prospects of where that's going to take me and what I'm going to see and what I'm going to photograph.
Wow. Well, I can't wait to see the resulting books of both of those projects. I love the title, We Cut Heads. That's a great title.
I will definitely get it published. I'm waiting on the publisher, but it's so new that no one's really seen it. But I've got a book dummy with me in New York, so I'm going to show some people.
Great, fantastic. So one final question, and then I'll let you go because I appreciate all the time that you've spent with me this afternoon. Where can someone find Pisgah New Guinea to purchase? Do you know that off at the top of your head?
Apart from Radius, the wonderful people at Radius, of course they can sure. get the book there. But I guess it's on Amazon. It's at the usual places. You know, I would assume that's really the best, you know, to just go online and try and track it down. But certainly directly through Radius might be the best way.
Okay, great. That's I'll make sure that there is a link to Radius that accompanies the podcast.
Yeah, so I mean, look, I had lots of them, but I don't have many left, so I'm the worst person to try and get books out of, but yeah, I would hope that there'd be still some available.
Great. I think so. Otherwise I don't think you would have been recommended
for
us to talk.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, no, that's great. Yeah. Hey, Lorena, thanks very much.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. And just best of luck with your projects and your time in New York.